There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if there's a fixer.
But Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, a special series from Left, Right, and Center. This show is all about President Trump's extensive and complicated legal issues. They bring up really good questions about free speech and defamation and Twitter and whether things are going well for you if you had to file a notice of apology to a federal judge. It was clear we needed to devote some time each week to answering some of the biggest legal questions, so I called Ken White. Ken is a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles and was formerly a federal prosecutor. He blogs about the law at popehat.com. He hosts the First Amendment podcast, Make No Law, and he's my co-host and legal navigator on this show. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
You know, I'm surprised you're here this morning.
Here we go. Yes, yes.
I was given to understand that you were going to be arrested on account of something in the terabytes of information that were seized from Roger Stone. A former member of British Parliament, Louise Mensch, said so on Twitter, and therefore it must be true.
Yes, this is going to involve an interesting conversation with my father, who follows my Twitter feed. I have been identified as part of the grand conspiracy surrounding the President of the United States, extending to Roger Stone and others. Through the series of red yarn strings that Ms. Mensch and her followers connect on various walls. I'm given to understand that my arrest for RICO and other things is imminent.
You know, Ken, I'm not sure you should be talking about this. One thing that you've frequently said to me on this show is that criminal defendants shouldn't talk so much about their cases in the media.
You know, that's true, but I figured that I'm the one who's smart enough to get away with it.
Speaking of smart enough to get away with it, let's talk about Roger Stone, who has had quite a week. Stone, listeners will recall, has been indicted for lying to federal investigators, and his pretrial proceedings have begun in Washington, D.C. So, of course, he posted on Instagram. He said, quote, "Through legal trickery, deep state hitman Robert S. Mueller III has guaranteed that my upcoming show trial is before Judge Amy Berman Jackson." He then added that Jackson is, quote, "an Obama-appointed judge," and that therefore, hashtag, fixes in. Accompanying that text, he posted a photo of Judge Jackson lifted from a right-wing website where there is a crosshairs above and to the left of her head. Or at least it looks like a crosshairs. Stone told the Washington Post that, quote, "it is evidentially, more correctly, a Celtic symbol." He said the inclusion of the symbol in any case was unintentional and that he is very, very sorry. Nonetheless, Judge Jackson issued a show cause order that requires Stone to appear before her in court on Thursday to explain why the post on Instagram wasn't a violation of his bail conditions or of the gag order that she had previously imposed. So let's talk about all the rules that Roger Stone may or may not have broken by making this post. So first of all, is the post itself a crime? People have been talking about the idea that it was either a threat against the judge or that it was incitement of a crime against the judge. Does it meet either of those definitions legally to be a threat or to be incitement?
I would say it definitely does not meet the definition of incitement. To be actionable incitement, something has to be intended and likely to cause imminent lawless action. So you're really talking about a situation where you're yelling at a crowd and telling them, go get those guys over there, where the action is immediate. The notion that this particular post in a sea of posts from Roger Stone blasting various political figures somehow was going to cause imminent violence or wrongful action, I think, is very unlikely. The threat analysis is a little harder. So to be a threat that's actionable, it has to be what's called a true threat. That means a reasonable person would have to take it as a sincere expression of intent to do harm, and the utterer must intend it that way. And here, even if you accept that this small symbol in the upper left of the picture is meant to be a crosshairs, and I don't know that's entirely clear, it's very small, it's in the corner, and it's clear this picture has just been cut and pasted from a loony conspiracy theory site. It's not as if Stone himself put the thing there. And he has a demonstrated history of cutting and pasting graphics from other places without looking at them too carefully. Like the time he had to apologize for posting something that had swastikas in it that he said he didn't recognize or notice. So
who among us?
I think it would be difficult to demonstrate that he intended that symbol in the corner to be a threat. And I think that a judge, someone with a slightly cooler head, would probably also question whether it's reasonably taken as one.
So if this doesn't appear to be a crime, it doesn't appear to be incitement, it doesn't appear to be a threat, isn't it Roger Stone's First Amendment right to do this dumb thing? I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why it's bad to do gratuitous, hostile insults of the judge who's going to preside over your criminal trial and might ultimately end up sentencing you. But isn't that Roger Stone's right? This is America. He gets to be a total idiot in public if he wants?
Generally, yes. But there's rights and then there's your ability to enjoy the rights in actual America. So law enforcement generally takes a very dim view of anything that they broadly construe as a threat to law enforcement or to judges or to the president or anything like that. So if you make something that a rather excitable person could possibly interpret as possibly implying a threat, it would not at all be unusual to be investigated, maybe quite vigorously, even if the ultimate decision is that it's protected by the First Amendment.
What about the gag order that Judge Jackson has imposed in the case? So there's already been concern about Roger Stone creating a media circus around himself. This gag order restricts what the attorneys in this case can say. But as for Stone, it only restricts what he's allowed to say in and around the courthouse. So can you describe why there was that relatively limited restriction imposed on Roger Stone? And then it seems to me like this could not possibly be a violation of that gag order because the gag order doesn't stop him from running his mouth on Instagram. It's basically just about the courthouse steps.
Exactly. Gag orders are difficult in First Amendment law. The law governing how far they can go is not as well developed as many other areas, and particularly in places like Washington, D.C., because the D.C. Circuit has not really addressed what the scope is. So what Judge Jackson did was find two narrow areas where it's fairly well established that a judge can take a firm hand. One of those is that it's well established that a judge can control the behavior of lawyers litigating before her in a particular case. And so that's the part of the gag order that says that the lawyers can't go out and say things in the media that might interfere with justice in the case, which God knows what that means. The other part she took advantage of is judges' ability to restrict disruptions and tumult in the immediate vicinity of the court that might interfere with court proceedings. And that's what she did basically to tell Stone and the witnesses, stop having your circus on the front step of the court. So she took the two narrowest areas she could with the clearest precedent allowing it that she could, and she sidestepped the much more difficult constitutional issues like, can you gag Roger Stone from saying things to the media in order to permit a fair trial when he's the one who's going to be tried and he wants to do it?
So then, given all of that, given that this Instagram post does not appear to have violated the gag order, that it does not appear to be a crime, you wrote a piece for The Atlantic basically saying more or less that you didn't expect Judge Jackson to do very much, at least at this stage, about this specific provocation, that it might not be great for Stone if and when he's in a situation where Judge Jackson is sentencing him, but that there wasn't a lot for her to do right now. And then she sort of surprised you right after your piece ran by issuing the order for this show cause hearing, basically requiring Roger Stone to come appear before her and explain why the post didn't violate the gag order, explain why the post shouldn't cause her to revise or revoke his bail conditions. So what do you expect to happen at this hearing on Thursday when Judge Jackson brings Stone before her to explain himself about this Instagram post?
Well, yes, that was a bit of a listen and humility, Josh. What I said was that I thought that she was adverse to unnecessary drama and adverse to playing in to Stone's desire for spectacle, so that I didn't think she would do too much. She, within like 45 seconds, responded with this minute order. An order to show cause simply tells the parties to come into court and be ready to discuss and justify something. And what she said was that she wanted Stone to explain, in light of this post, why she shouldn't modify, revoke his bail or modify her gag order. That doesn't necessarily mean she's actually prepared to do those things. Issuing an OSC like this could be a very sharp tug on the leash, warning Stone that he's getting close to something that's going to get him in trouble. Or she could actually go further. I mean, she may view that Instagram post as a genuine threat to her. I think she wants to avoid unnecessary disputes. And if she put a full gag order on him about what he can say to the media, that's a guaranteed appeal immediately to the Court of Appeals over First Amendment issues. Stone would revel in that. And I think she's smart enough not to want to give him that avenue and forum.
So how did this case end up in front of Judge Jackson? We talk a lot on this show about long-suffering federal judge James Otero. It feels like we also might need to talk about long-suffering federal judge Amy Berman Jackson. How come she ended up with this case? Was it, in fact, legal trickery by deep state hitman Robert S. Mueller III?
No, it's something very mundane that happens in federal courthouses all over the country every day. There's a motion called a related case motion, and it's a form. You fill it out. You say, court, just so you know, this thing I'm filing today is related to that prior case. You know, it has the same defendants, or it involves the same incident, or it's otherwise, there are about 10 factors related to it. And the judge looks at it, and if they're satisfied, yeah, that's related, it tends to go then to the judge who had the first case. That's because there's a sense that judicial economy is served if the same judge is hearing all the matters arising out of the same facts and the same events. In this particular case, Judge Jackson had an indictment brought by special counsel's office against a series of Russian hackers who have never been arrested or brought to court. And the special counsel's position is that the same search warrant that yielded the evidence against those Russian hackers also yielded evidence against Roger Stone, and that the two cases are therefore related.
So there was also a filing from the special counsel's office about this related case issue, and we learned something interesting from that filing, which is that one of the things they say Roger Stone lied about was when he said he was never in direct contact with WikiLeaks, but they say, in fact, he was in direct contact with WikiLeaks, or Organization One, as it is referred to in the filing. So that seems significant, right? Because we know about Roger Stone, you know, the claim that he used Randy Cretico, the weird gadfly comedian, as a go-between with Julian Assange. But this, I think, is the first on the record allegation that we have from the special counsel that Stone was directly in contact with WikiLeaks.
Yes, and it's kind of an example of how a dumb litigation tactic can get more bad information out there about your client. Stone challenged the moving his case to Judge Jackson under the related case system, saying there was no reason to do it. And that basically opened the door for the special counsel to say, well, actually, here's all the reasons that they are related, and here's the stuff about you talking to WikiLeaks.
Can we talk about this big New York Times article this week that discusses the president's years-long efforts to interfere in the many investigations into and around him? The article is very interesting. A lot of it lays out things that we already knew, but puts them in a useful chronological timeline. I thought one of the most interesting things in the article had to do with the president's frustration about the Southern District of New York investigation into Michael Cohen. The president felt that Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, had misled him by telling him the investigation wasn't about him, that it was about Cohen's business dealings. And in fact, it turns out to be about a number of things, including Cohen's business dealings. And then when there were embarrassing disclosures about the president and Michael Cohen's guilty plea, the president asked the acting attorney general, who was then Matt Whitaker, to put U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Berman in charge of the case. Now, Jeffrey Berman runs the office of the U.S. attorney in Southern District of New York, but he's been recused from these Cohen cases because he's recused from matters related to Trump because he donated money to Trump during the campaign. The president wanted Berman to assert control over the case, presumably because the president thinks that Berman is loyal to him, but Berman is recused and Berman stayed recused. It doesn't appear that Matt Whitaker actually did anything about the president's request. So what I find interesting about this story is that, you know, the president thought he had picked these people who were loyal to him, Jeffrey Berman, Matt Whitaker, people that a lot of the president's critics were very nervous about being put in these positions of power. But it looks at least in this instance, and this feels like a pattern that we've seen over and over again, that they didn't actually lift a finger to try to obstruct justice, or, you know, even if it wasn't, it wouldn't have been the crime of obstruction of justice. They didn't lift a finger to interfere with the investigation in the way the president wished for them to do when it counted.
No, and even the way the president, as described in this article, went about it is singularly unimpressive. I mean, I read it as being phrased more that he asked Whitaker if Berman could be put on the case, not even, you know, a Nixonian command, go do it. And nothing happened. And, you know, Josh, to be honest, that's just sad to me. That's not real obstruction of justice. Josh, this is America. We overthrow governments. We sell arms to terrorists to get money to give arms to other terrorists. We try to kill people with poisoned wetsuits and exploding cigars. You know, when we come to the table, we mean it. This is not a sincere attempt at obstruction of justice. This is just literally phoning it in.
Is it possible that Matt Whitaker and various other people that the president has installed in these positions in the Department of Justice, that they have interfered with the investigations in ways that are not obvious to us, that are not obvious to the press, that wouldn't have left public traces that would have made it clear what they did? Because I think, you know, people, including me, were quite bothered by the Matt Whitaker appointment.
Well, certainly there could be many ways that they could have influenced government witnesses to cooperate or not cooperate, deterred investigators from going in different directions, slowed down the production of documents or witnesses. But it does seem as if so far a lot of these people, however seemingly loyal to Trump they were not people who wanted to be in the history books for the wrong reasons.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we will talk about who else? Paul Manafort. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. Paul Manafort is getting closer to being sentenced. The special counsel's office filed a memo with the court agreeing with the assessment that the federal sentencing guidelines recommend a sentence of 19.5 to 24.5 years for Paul Manafort. But what Robert Mueller and his prosecution team did not do is explicitly recommend that sentence, or any other sentence, to Judge Amy Berman Jackson, saying simply that his sentence should reflect the severity of his crimes. So, Ken, what does this mean? Why would Mueller not recommend a specific sentence for Paul Manafort?
I think that he may have thought that simply laying all the cards on the table about how badly Manafort acted was more powerful than advocating for a specific big number. You know, you're already talking about a range that is likely a death sentence for Paul Manafort. And what the special counsel did is, yes, say this is the range and we're not specifying a sentence you should give, but... And then he went through all the bad things Manafort did, how all the statutory legal factors you're supposed to use in a sentence were against him, how he shouldn't get credit for accepting responsibility, how he obstructed justice, how the court has the discretion to impose this huge sentence. Basically, he laid out every factor against Manafort and then basically said, but do what you're going to do. I think that shows a certain level of confidence in the judge. And they've read the judge that she is not inclined to give him some sort of very easy sentence. I think that the transcripts of the hearings before the judge bear that out. So I think they're stepping back a bit and really putting the judge in the driver's seat.
So over the last few weeks, the key dispute in this case after Paul Manafort had pleaded guilty was about the matter of Paul Manafort's cooperation and basically whether he had been intentionally misleading the special counsel's office when he was supposed to be cooperating with them, instead lying to them. And so there had been, you know, a number of motions and hearings about this before Judge Jackson, right, where she was trying to figure out, you know, whether he had really made false statements, whether those false statements had been intentional, whether it was, you know, materially causing problems for the special counsel, that sort of thing. So what did she end up determining about Paul Manafort's behavior? Because presumably that's going to be important in the sentencing when you have to decide, you know, was Paul Manafort a cooperator who deserves a reduction in the sentence for the fact that he took responsibility and tried to help out the special counsel's office? Or is he somebody who compounded his bad behavior by seeking to obstruct justice after the fact?
she determined two things, two different things. The first one was about whether or not he breached his cooperation agreement. The government's cooperation agreement basically says that they can determine whether or not you've breached it. And if they've made a good faith determination, then the judge doesn't second guess it. So what Judge Berman Jackson did was look at the evidence and say, okay, the government's made a good faith determination that he's lied to them and breached the cooperation agreement. They're no longer bound by it. They can recommend whatever they want at sentencing. That's part one. Part two is she made some factual determinations about what he actually lied about. And there she made them by a different evidentiary standard. She said that she found by preponderance of the evidence, that is, you know, 51%, that he had lied about three specific areas. She found they hadn't proved as to two other areas, but the three will be plenty. The reason it's important that she made specific findings that he lied during his cooperation about three things is that can have an impact on sentencing. It will likely mean that he cannot get credit for pleading guilty. When you enter a guilty plea in federal court, you get 2 or 3 points of credit in this incredibly complicated alchemy that comes up with a recommended number. And if you misbehave after you've pled guilty, you can lose that credit. So this is signifying he won't get that credit and that he can get an upward enhancement for obstruction of justice. Although that was pretty much a foregone conclusion because one of his convictions was trying to suborn witnesses. So these things she's finding, I don't think that numerically in the guideline calculation they have a big effect. It might be the difference between like, oh, great, so now he's at 18 to 23 years instead of 19 to 24 years. The big picture is that it's an indication she's definitely found she's lied, and that is the mood, the feeling she goes into. She did say at one point during the sealed hearing, you know, it's clear I can't sentence him to more than the statutory maximum for what he pled guilty to.
That's not a great thing to hear.
No, as a defense lawyer, that's not the sort of thing that gives me optimism that I'm going to get a low sentence.
One of my favorite things in here was that one of Manafort's defenses about why he made statements that were false was that he is in bad health and that he was too sick to remember the facts of the things that he was being asked about. And among the responses that the judge had to that was that that he hadn't filed anything challenging the conditions of his confinement, which you would think he would do if he was so sick that he couldn't really provide accurate answers in an interrogation. And the other thing is that some of the gout that he's been suffering occurred after he lied to the government, so that couldn't have caused him to lie in the past.
Yeah, that was a dumb argument for him to make.
Do you want to make a prediction of what sentence Judge Jackson's going to hand down, because you've been so good at predicting Judge Jackson's behavior in the last couple of weeks?
I would be surprised if he gets less than 15 years.
Speaking of trouble, not quite as severe trouble as Paul Manafort, let's talk about Michael Avenatti. We discussed a few weeks ago Michael Avenatti's new, more humble office digs on Sunset Boulevard, no longer right by the Cheesecake Factory in Fashion Island. But the question is, has he contracted his fancy Cheesecake Factory lifestyle enough for somebody who's in as severe financial distress as he is? You will recall that Jason Frank, an ex-law partner of Avenatti's, received a multi-million-dollar court judgment last year to compensate him for profits he never received from the firm Egan Avenatti. Well, Egan Avenatti went bankrupt in 2017, and Frank alleges that Michael Avenatti diverted funds that were supposed to be available to pay the creditors of Egan Avenatti, such as himself, since he's owed that big judgment. Here's how the LA Times describes how Jason Frank has been characterizing what Michael Avenatti has been spending this money on. Avenatti used some of his money for personal expenses, such as $13,000 in rent for his Century City apartment, a $3,640 payment for his Ferrari, $21,000 for Passport 420, an Avenatti company that owns a Honda Jet, $150,000 for his troubled coffee company, Global Baristas, $53,600 for his ex-wife, Christine Carlin, and $232,875 for HTP Motorsport, which is Michael Avenatti's auto racing team. So having seen all of these expenses and claiming that Michael Avenatti is misdirecting these funds that are supposed to be available to pay Jason Frank last week asked a federal magistrate judge to place Egan Avenatti under a receiver. And then Michael Avenatti consented to that. So now all of that firm's assets and its financial inflows and outflows will be monitored by this outside party. But Avenatti says it's no big deal because all the action anyway, it's not at Egan Avenatti. It's at his new firm, Avenatti & Associates. And he says they've never had so many or such big clients. Avenatti says, quote, "There has never been any misdeeds or fraud. Any claim to the contrary is politically motivated, completely bogus, and driven by Jason's own personal demons and vendetta." So, Ken, is this normal?
Not even remotely. It's huge to have your law firm placed into receivership, even if it's, you know, the last law firm that you've shed like a skin to move on to your new one. That is gigantic and normally would be seen as a career ender for a lawyer who is less known for rising from the ashes. And the allegations in this motion for receivership are very stark and very troubling. I think we have to take into account this comes from a opponent, a former partner. They clearly are very bitter rivals that are in a very nasty litigation. So the things that he's claiming about Avenatti should be viewed with some skepticism. But if some of these things are true, they are the type of things that can lead to bankruptcy fraud investigations and referrals to the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I trust that Mr. Avenatti has appropriate counsel close by because, you know, reading that brief, I thought this is the type of thing that I've seen bankruptcy trustees refer to the U.S. Attorney's Office for investigation.
So when you think about Avenatti and his new firm, Avenatti & Associates, and obviously Stormy Daniels is a client of his, but if you're a tort lawyer, tort litigation involves, it can often be very long and expensive, and the lawyer bears all of those costs on the way through with the hopes of collecting something like a third of the judgment or of the settlement that is ultimately received at the end of the case. And so if you are a client going out and hiring a tort lawyer, you need to feel fairly confident that they have the financial resources to see your case through. You don't want them to run out of money halfway through, not be able to pay expenses when you think that you have a valid claim that, you know, given that you put in that litigation expense, will ultimately lead to a significant recovery. So how does someone like Michael Avenatti go out and get business right now? I mean, I realize he's on television, but you would think that this, you know, this large whiff of financial difficulty would make it really difficult to sign up clients.
Well, Josh, you just described a way that a thoughtful, serious, prudent person would hire a lawyer. And many people hiring lawyers aren't thoughtful, serious, or prudent. They are impressed by flash and aggression and fast talk and that type of thing, things that Avenatti very much has. So he will continue to draw in litigants because they like his fight. They like his pugnaciousness. They like his willingness to talk hard against the other side, and that will continue to attract clients who don't really think too closely about the other issues.
So what you're saying there is that Michael Avenatti is a good lawyer.
No. I would say he needs a good lawyer, but I think whether someone is a good lawyer needs to be on a case-by-case evaluation, and the bankruptcy case certainly doesn't seem to support it. The recent Trump cases in California are not supporting it. I would have to answer that on a case-by-case basis, Josh. I'm not ready to say that as a global matter.
There is so much more for us to talk about, but I think that is a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, send us your questions. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW and on Facebook, too. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our associate producer is Rosalie Atkinson. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken White and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.